Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Carrie Pat Schlarbaum. And we will be talking about those among us who are wild, red-haired, and beautiful. Now this is, after all, the week of St. Patrick's Day. We salute you if you are Irish. May the luck of the Irish be with you. But during this hour, we will be talking about the other wild, red-haired, and beautiful folks among us. Foxes. Sooner or later, whether you are in town or in the country, if you keep your eyes open and your senses sharp, you will see something beautiful and red flash by. May you be so lucky as to see a fox. Foxes are all around us, and they are adapting to the changing environment in ways that make it more visible to us. Let me tell you more about this wild and elusive animal. Let's start by speaking with someone who has spent more than 30 years trying to capture the beauty of foxes with his camera. Roger Hill is from Roland. He is a nature photographer and a lifelong conservationist. I caught up to him at a roadside fox den northeast of Roland. I asked him some questions to help us get to know more about foxes. Roger, we're covering foxes on Local Talk this week. Would you tell our listeners what you find so fascinating about foxes?
They're cute, for one thing, but those little fox, the 2, 3, 4, 5, I've had up to 8 at one time, all looking at me at the same time, perked at you, and all 16 ears pointing at you, like you get their attention. Or else the ones where they're kissing each other and all that stuff.
What's your strategy to get the young ones to perk up their ears?
A little girl's doll, they used to always have squeakers in them.
Yeah.
Where you press on the doll and it'd make little cry noises.
Yeah.
And I just keep that in my right hand.
Yeah.
You don't want to do anything until they've been used to you 2 or 3 nights. Mm-hmm. You know, you sitting there and nothing happens. That's the main thing. And then they get confident.
Yeah.
The best thing I've found is when I get 2, 3 shots and... A lot of times you just waste your first shot when they're not, nothing's looking at you. You just take one, then be ready, because they all look at you.
Yeah.
But after you do that 2, 3 times, you know, nothing happened. So they start playing again.
Yeah.
Well, then I keep that whistle type thing in my left shirt pocket.
Okay.
And that way all I had to do was pull my elbow in
and
squeak it a couple times quick and be ready. And then I'd already be on them, and that way I'd get 2, 3 more shots.
Yeah.
One time I had the 2 dens by the McCullsburg Cemetery. My camera had gotten lightly wet one day, and the rewind-up lever started squeaking every time afterwards when I'd rewind a roll of film. And then one night I had 8 baby fox out, and I was under a camouflage netting, and they're a lot spookier then. And when I started to wind up that film, this little squeak, 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 it's a lot like a mouse squeak.
Yeah.
Anyway, 3 of them come running up, right up to me. One of them came under my camouflage and had both feet on one of my shoes at one time looking up at me winding that film. And another time I took a friend along, and he was going to video the fox, then me photographing the fox. I was out about 30 feet away from the fence. There's a rocky ground around there, a lot of just plain gravel type. Small thumb-sized stones, rocks. I picked up little rocks and I'd flip them where I wanted them to go.
Oh.
And they'd take off and run, so he'd get action stuff. Well, one time I grabbed a handful of them, and I just started throwing them towards the guy that was videoing. And I just walked them right over to him, and the last one hit the cameraman on the foot. And the fox ran out right over and smelled his foot. And he's standing there shooting foot, videoing right down on his foot with the fox on it. You get so much pleasure out of them, and then you make a... make them vulnerable. You're changing their life, accepting you. You're suckering them. You just feel bad that way. One of the most important things to me is that when you decide not to do it anymore, the last day that you're on a den, the last night that you're going to do it, you want to let them get out, and the first time they turn their back on you, not paying attention, just jump up and run straight at them. I'll usually have a handful of like soybeans or a pocket full of soybeans or corn, and I'll have that already. And when they're least expecting anything to happen, I'll just terrorize them.
Yeah.
And that just scares the living daylights. Oh, you can't believe how fast they can move. And I figure that helps them, you know, don't trust anybody.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and today we have been talking about foxes, the wild animals among us. To learn more about them, I contacted Ron Andrews. Ron is a retired research biologist for the Department of Natural Resources. I asked him to share some of his vast knowledge about foxes. We're here today with Ron Andrews, a wildlife extraordinaire individual, to talk about foxes in Iowa. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Pat.
Ron, we've invited you today to talk about foxes here in Iowa. Can you tell me where you grew up and how the fox population's doing in your part of Iowa?
Well, Pat, I grew up in the southwest corner of the state near Red Oak, Iowa. But after I got my college degree, I started a full-time fur bearer resource job up at Clear Lake, Iowa, and actually cut my teeth on a study of red fox.
Tell me a little how that got started.
You know, that was a lot of fun. When I came to Clear Lake, Iowa there to start work, the project was actually about 1 year underway, so it kind of gave me something to start right out with. In that particular first part of the project, we were ear tagging red fox with little button ear tags with numbers on them, just like leg banding waterfowl, so that we knew where they were tagged. We were doing this at fox dens, tagging the pups primarily, a few adults. And then when they were hunted or trapped, they could report those numbers to us. And we got an idea of movement and mortality with that tagging effort.
I remember the first time seeing a fox. I could probably take it to the woods right where I was standing, and it was on the bank of a pond, and the sun broke through. And what an incredibly handsome, beautiful creature. The red, the black, the white, the blonde. What was your interest in foxes?
Well, I think it's that luxurious fur that actually does it for a lot of people, myself included. Photographers really love to go out on the landscape and watch foxes play out there, whether it's movie or whether it's just still pictures. It's
pretty
a really
exciting thing in our Iowa landscape to appreciate foxes.
The triggering thing for me was probably just the fact that I got to start on that project right away after I started to work. And just seeing those fox pups and how playful they are at den sites, that was very fascinating, too. So it was a very enjoyable project, to say the least. We did 1,500 foxes with ear tags, and we decided we better go one step further, sort of the icing on the cake, and place some radio collars on these animals and more closely monitor their movements out there in the environment and the landscape. And what we found is that males moved a more greater distance, you know, average 30, 40 miles per each individual animal in the fall of the year, and females about 10 or 15, considerably less. And when they start to move, it's a straight line distance. You know, they don't vary very much from that line unless there's a barrier in front of them. And it seems like as they get to the end of the trail, there's a looping pattern. Somewhere along that way, they found what they really like, but they think, well, gosh, this is kind of thinking like a fox. They go to explore a little bit further, and then they come back to that point. So you've seen loops at the end of those trails, too. And it's very fascinating. We had a few animals that actually exceeded 100 miles, but averaging for males, 40, for females, about 10 or 15.
So when you mentioned the straight line movements, was that correlated to fence lines and...
You know, I don't think it was, Pat. Some of that occurs. There's definitely that occurs out there, particularly if you're a trapper. You learn to pick up on those fox trails and that sort of thing. But it seems like that they would just get a beeline out there and something kept them going in that direction until a major obstacle occurred, like a lake or a town or that sort of thing. And then they figure out how to get around that. And it's interesting, again, if they wanted to move further, they get back on that same diagonal, that same bearing, and keep moving until they found that loop that they wanted
to. Do those transects intersect with other foxes?
They will do that, particularly those young of the year, as they're starting to explore for new territories up. Once they get settled in, though, there's a territory that's sort of set up. And say another fox is moving along and happens to intersect what he realizes is a territory out there, they'll go on to a different spot. The females moved a lot less, 10, 15 mile average. And I'm not exactly sure what key to that, but I do know with a lot of wildlife, the males tend to move greater distances than the females. They must be more homebodies, I guess you might expect that with the wildlife world as well.
As I recall, there was an impact on the foxes here in Iowa when the coyotes came in. How did that coexistence work?
Well, you know, coyotes are certainly a factor out there. By far and away, the biggest factor, though, is the mange, and that seems to be true throughout the United States. However, again, like any predator, and coyotes were larger, given the opportunity, they're going to take fox pups and occasionally adult foxes as well. So it's all part of that big equation out there when it comes to survival of the fittest.
How was the impact on the fox community? You say it was growing then. How has it held up over time?
You know, that's an interesting thing in itself. If you look back prior to the time I started in southern Iowa, the 1950s or so, the early 60s, that's where the highest density of red foxes were. So where we used to have cycles, ups and downs, pretty much every few years. Late 60s, and that's when the population in north, central, northeast Iowa was really growing. And probably key to all that, I think, was just a nice expanse of grassland habitat, which provided a lot of mouse and other small mammal forage for the foxes to feed upon, and the population doing very well. Now it seems like it's at a low status quo for some time now. I would say they're probably down 75% of what they were then. And foxes have been able to hang on, but not in great numbers in various parts of the state now. And they kind of keep staying on that sort of plateau, a lower level plateau. This can't seem to increase anymore. And once you see a little bump in the population increasing, well, that mange tends to knock it back again.
Well, what is mange? How is that spread?
It's spread by a mange mite. It's what they call a sarcoptic mite that starts feeding on the animal skin and hair and that sort of thing. Then they just start to just basically sort of wilt in existence there. They just kind of go down to nothing. They lose their fur. They're exposed to cold conditions, and they just lose out all the way around. They become very weak. As coyotes increase, particularly increase in northern Iowa because I was closer there, the foxes hit the mange, and that depleted the population. But as foxes have tried to survive, they have moved basically to the old farmsteads, abandoned buildings, that sort of thing, sort of away from the center of the sections where coyotes find their security.
And we seem to see more and more foxes in the urban setting.
Exactly so. A reason I'm sure for that, too, is that coyote pressure out there. And the fact that it's a good thing these animals can adapt, because even with the fox, the grasslands are disappearing in the north part of the state, and so they find mice and small mammals, mice and rodents, that sort of thing, rabbits, and so they can find those around the city settings.
What's it mean to take your children and your grandchildren?
Well, you know, especially to give kids, my kids, grandkids, and kids both, some insights to the great outdoors and the wonderful things that they can experience with that is absolutely super. I always tell kids that, you know, get high on nature, forget all that other baloney that's out there that's going to cause you all kinds of grief. The best thing you can do is get out there, appreciate the environment, take care of the environment, and you're going to live a very happy life.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and for you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. See skies of blue, clouds of white, the bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, what a colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? And they're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry, I watch them grow. They'll learn so much more than I'll ever, ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
You are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and today we are talking about the fact that we have foxes living in Iowa, in towns as well as in the country, and how much pleasure many of us are getting from seeing these beautiful animals. I am Pat Schlarbaum, your host today, and in my journeys around the area to speak with fox lovers, I visited Hans Geppinger, a Boone County farmer. Hans has an environmental conscience and has enjoyed many wildlife experiences through the years. I know that Hans has taken unique actions to help wild foxes. He built a fox den far away from roads to encourage foxes to raise their pups in a safe place where they won't get hit by traffic. I wanted to find out what foxes mean to him, so I went to talk with him.
I see a creature of beauty and cunning and agility, quite attractive to look at. Well, there's interesting stories. One experience that comes to mind right now that I got to see, I was in a deer stand long after the deer season, just up there watching wildlife, saw a fox, and the ground was all covered with snow, so this would have been in January or February. And here's a fox with its nose in the snow running, following a mouse tunnel, and was zigzagging. You could tell it was following the rodent tunnel in the snow. And the snow was going just like a V snowplow on the front of a snow clearing vehicle, or like a speedboat going through the water. It was throwing snow both directions. So anyway, that's one beautiful thing that I got to see one time, probably a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I know of a golfer at a Boone golf course that was out early one morning with three other golfers and were approaching a green, and here came a fox, this is at just past sunrise, with a dead 13-striped ground squirrel in its mouth, and it didn't even veer away from him. It went right across the green and was holding its head up, just proud as could be, with this 13-striped ground squirrel that had just killed, draped like a mustache out both sides of its mouth. Well, people remember something like that. It's a beautiful sight. A lot of hunters today will not shoot a fox, but will shoot coyotes because they know they predate or make life tough for fox, and that's why we're seeing fox in city environments. Mm-hmm. I can speak to the city of Ogden, Boone, and Ames of firsthand observation by people that see them often in urban environments. And back in the 60s and the 70s, you didn't see a fox inside of any town. But pressure from coyotes from when they moved in here, which is a recent phenomenon for the state of Iowa to have coyotes all over the whole state, we know that they predate on and will kill fox. That's why many of us feel, anyway, that we're seeing them inside city limits, urban environments. And, of course, they're wonderful mousers, and there's mice everywhere. Mice aren't just in the country. They're any place where people live.
How were foxes treated when you were growing up? Did your neighbors treat foxes as vermin?
I remember hearing from other people that they didn't like fox because the fox would get in the chicken coop at night and kill them. Well, I think it possibly was just a good excuse to kill fox, because in many cases it was either raccoons or some other critter that was in there killing them. The fox were doing that. They were getting a lot of help from other wildlife. It wasn't just fox, but fox were more fun to hunt, and it gave a real good excuse for young boys to go out and grown men to kill fox. I think, Pat, that today there's been a complete change in the attitude of people that are active hunters. I talked to many of them and hear secondhand reports from people that talk to somebody else that many people won't kill a fox at all. They don't like coyotes, but they feel sorry for the fox.
As I said earlier, Hans created a fox den site to avoid seeing them as road-killed fox. So I asked him to explain his experiment.
I've always had an interest in wildlife, and when I was farming at this location that we're at right now with the buildings and machine sheds and shops and stuff, it's next to a busy road. And over a period of 10 years, we've had vixens, the female fox, den right next to a county blacktop road on the north side of Boone. And they were using a culvert as an entrance to a den. And in 2010, the Vixen had 5 kits. And we got pictures of them and got to see them playing when they were old enough to go outside alongside this road. And not long after that, second Vixen brought her kits in to join the first Vixen. And for a while, we had 8 kits together. And this lasted about 2 weeks. Eventually, one morning, 2 of the kits had been killed overnight out on the road. So I thought, well, I'm going to try to provide a more enticing or safer place for the fox to den. So we knew what the diameter of the culvert, the steel culvert was, which was 12 inches, about 1,000 feet away from the road. We had an embankment, and up in the embankment, we buried a doggaloo, one of those that has the snout that sticks out from it, and ran 2 separate field drain tile, plastic field drain tile, back to this den that we had made out of a doggaloo. And we know from research that fox often like a second escape way out of the den, and that's why we ran 2 pipes about 15 feet apart, something like that, back to this buried doggaloo. And we kind of tried to do it upright. We let the top of the doggaloo protrude above the ground about 3 inches because it had a vent in it. And then we put a plastic tub on upside down over the top of that vent and a piece of concrete on top of that so it wouldn't blow away, and are hoping to get fox in there. And this year, for the first time, we can, which this year meaning 2013, we can smell fox. If you smell at the end of one of these 2 entrances, and we've seen tracks, so we're very, very hopeful. Last year we didn't have any fox in there, but we're hopeful.
Well, and you mentioned that aroma. Could you describe the scent of a fox?
Sure. Let's start from the smelliest thing that most people are acquainted with. A skunk has a very distinctive odor that you can't miss. We've all had the experience of having close calls or experience with skunk. And then the next step down on strong odor would be a coyote. And then the least odoriferous would be a fox. Well, this is definitely not a coyote and definitely not a skunk that we're smelling, and it does smell like a fox den. So that did not happen the first year, but I think that sometimes when things are new, wildlife is skeptical of it, or perhaps those things had human odor on them a year ago. It maybe is just we're hoping that it just takes them a while to get used to something new and different. Yeah, and they have a good source of rabbits. Close at hand in this pine windbreak, and there always has been a rabbit population here, so I'm sure that may help a little bit to sustain the fox when they have hungry kits.
So you can almost imagine school children someday with this vantage point right here beside your shop and being able to see foxes in a artificial den, but all the natural affairs of the world can be right here before them.
Yeah, I would look forward to sharing that with young people.
Well, I'll be more than happy to return when you got your grandkids and your school kids here. This will be a lot of fun.
Thanks, Pat.
Well, thank you, Hans, and keep up the good work. Thank you for all you do for conservation.
Yes, sir.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And today we've been talking about foxes, the wild animals among us. I felt there was one more stop I needed to make in my explorations. I knew, like many Iowans, that the name fox is often used to describe the Meskwaki people, who have maintained continued residency in Iowa, dating back to long before contact with European settlers. I realized I did not really understand why the Meskwaki people are also called the fox. So I went to speak with Jonathan Buffalo, the museum director and historian for the Meskwaki settlement. He started out by sharing his own delight with seeing foxes near him. Then he explained why the term fox is used in relation to the Meskwaki people. In the process, I gained a new understanding of how their society was structured and their wisdom about government. Today we have the privilege of joining Jonathan Buffalo, a Meskwaki historian.
My official title is Historic Preservation Director, and I'm also the tribal historian for the tribal council. And since we have the museum, I'm also the museum director. We've always had foxes on the settlement. You know, one time I was driving down the road, and there was this little kit standing by the road, the little baby fox. So I stopped, rolled down my window, and I said it in Indian, you know, I said it in Meskwaki, I said, "What are you doing?" You know, "Chap, get the shay." Said, "Where are you going?" "Dabayan." And he looked up at me and he jumped into the weeds, and that was it. It was kind of fun to see a little fox standing by the road.
Are foxes included in your ceremonial songs or?
Well, the fox is one of our revered animals. We revere every creature on earth as Meskwakis, from the smallest to the largest. You know, we revere everything. But we do have special spots for some animals, like the fox, the wolf, the bear, the eagles. In that sense, because they're clan animals.
Jonathan Buffalo described the foxes as a clan animal. So I asked him what clans were and what roles they played in the government of the Meskwaki Nation.
In our government, we had a fox clan chief, a bear clan chief, and a thunder clan chief. Three chiefs. On the bottom are village chiefs that govern their villages separately. Mm-hmm. But the top layer is those three, mm-hmm. and they have a council themselves, mm-hmm. made up of the clans. That was the chief's council. Mm-hmm. How it worked was, there's this fox chief who's war chiefs, there's the bear clan chiefs who are the peace chiefs, then there's this thunder clan. The thunder clan chiefs will never actually govern. They just have the authority to take it and give it, because these two would be fighting for authority. A peace chief, the bear clan chiefs, will never give up on peace. That's their job. Even if they're getting killed, they'll always try and find peace.
And that's the bear clan.
That's the bear clan. They'll always look at it peacefully. Even if the enemy's at the door, they will not give up at peace and try to find a solution. Sometimes there is no solution. So what the Thunder Clan chief did was, when the enemy's at the door, he would take authority from the Bear Clan chiefs, the peace chiefs, and give it to the Fox Clan chiefs, the war chiefs, and say, "Here, you have governing power." Then the first thing the war chiefs would do is declare martial law, and everything would be under their rule. Then we're at war. If there was a war, an invading army, the Fox Clan, they would be in charge of government at that time. And the war chiefs are like any military organization in the country. United States has the military complex, and they're always for war. Same way with the war chiefs. They were always for war. They would look for enemies. And if you had them as a government, you would always be in war. These two cannot give each other that.
The bear and the fox.
Yeah, cannot exchange. It would be a civil war.
Internal struggle, peace and war.
Yeah, the internal struggle of peace and war. They need this third entity. This third one has the authority to take it and give it. So after the war, just so we don't have a military dictatorship governing us, the Thunder Clan chief would take that authority from the war chiefs, take it away from them, and give it back to the peace chiefs. Because after the war chiefs would be out looking for enemy. So to stop that, the Thunder Clan chief would take it back and give it back to the peace chiefs. Then we would be at peace again. Under peacetime situations, they were actually the police. They would guard the villages.
Do the Fox Clan provide security?
Traditionally, they were the police.
Police.
Under peacetime.
Maybe our listeners have heard about the Meskwaki and the Sauk and Fox Nation. We're focusing on Fox today. Could you share some of the history of the Fox Nation?
The basic story goes when the French met the first Meskwakis, they asked who they were, and they just happened to be from the Fox Clan. And these group of Meskwakis answered, "We're from the Fox Clan." And the French reporter or explorer wrote down, "Met the Renards today." So we received the name Renards, which the English later on translated to fox. That's been the main version of why we received the name fox. But then there's been a couple other minor versions of it. One version is that because we stole from the French traders, they called us foxes. And during the Fox Wars, the French called us fox to animalize us, to make us animals. So they called us fox. Because in Europe, the fox was a nuisance. They killed foxes in Europe. So it's far easier to kill an animal than a human. So they made us into animals. That's how that version of how we became fox. But we've always been Meskwaki. You have to remember, as a people, we've been on this continent for thousands of years. And over time, we had our own names for ourselves. We had names for tribes. They each had their own names. Then after contact, these tribes were either named by the white people. And for us, we were Meskwakis. And we are Meskwakis today. And That's what our creation name is, Squawkies, Red Earth People, which comes from our creation story of being created out of Red Earth. And we believe in our creation story just as much as anybody else in the world that has a creation story. And that creation story says we were created out of Red Earth by our Creator. When the Europeans came, we met the French first. They, of course, were coming down the river system into the Mississippi Valley. And eventually, about 1600s, they finally reached our area. The first name they knew us by was Outagamie, which means people of the other side, because we lived on the south shore of Lake Superior. And the Chippewas lived in the northern part. So they called us the other side people. So by 1660s, when we finally met the French, is when we received the name Renard, which means fox in French. And so that's how that accounts for the name fox. So when the British come, after the French and Indian War, the British come into the area, they tended to call us Meskwakis in their records. They still used the name Fox, but of all the groups we met, including the Americans, they tended to use Meskwaki. And then after the Revolutionary War comes, the Americans come into the area, and they called us Fox. And by that time, our cousin tribe, the Sauk, and the Meskwakis were living together in Iowa, Illinois, Missouri area. And for treaty purposes, the government, the U.S. government, made treaties with the Fox tribe. And those were peace treaties. But for land cession treaties, the government created the Sac and Fox tribe for treaty purposes. Even though at that time, they were two different tribes, similar but different. And we don't tend to use it among ourselves. Anything tribal, we tend to use Meskwaki, like Meskwaki Powwow. We use the name Fox in government usage, you know, the Sac and Fox Tribal Council. Under land cession treaties, it's always under the Sac and Fox tribe, or the Sacs and Foxes tribe, Sac and Fox Nation, things like that. And in the meantime, the Sac and Fox get removed to Kansas. And in Kansas, the Sauk tribe goes on to Oklahoma. And the Fox tribe comes back to Iowa, still known as Sac and Fox. So the Iowa group, which were mostly culturally Meskwakis, became known as the Sac and Fox of Iowa. Thank you.
I'd read were, quote, know that the fox are immortal. Mm-hmm. Is there a Meskwaki word for fox?
Wagosha. Wagosha is the word for fox.
Thank you.
And that man that said those words in 1712, he wasn't just saying it as a boast. You know, he wasn't just being boastful, but he trusted that we'll exist. He was talking about us when he said those, because he knew they were going to die. He knew his group of Meskwakis were going to die. Next day, maybe the next day, but soon. So when he said those words, he wasn't saying Meskwakis were gods, but the Meskwaki spirit was immortal. And the man probably said, know that the Meskwakis are immortal. That's what he probably said. It's been recorded as, know we that the foxes are immortal, because that's what the French called us. So that's how come we use the official quote. But he probably said, know that the Meskwakis are immortal. The Meskwaki chief probably didn't say foxes, because we didn't call ourselves foxes. But in history, it's recorded that way. So today, in those words, we're the immortal part of that. That doesn't mean we're gods, but our Meskwakiness is immortal. You know, it's because we still exist. And our religion, our language, our belief that we are Meskwaki, that's the immortal part. You know, that's the immortal part of being, of that know we that the foxes are immortal. You know. But this bioregion, the Northeast, traditionally it's an Algonquin homeland. It's a very harsh environment, really, if you look at it. It's a very harsh environment, but it's also a very enjoyable environment. One thing that our environment teaches us is never take things for granted. That's how come people in our area always have warm coats in the car. You might be going to town when it's nice, but you might be leaving town in a snowstorm. Mm-hmm. Always be ready and always be prepared, either stocking food and things like that. I think we're all in that mindset of our environment. And as people, I think we have to protect our environment, because if the rest of the country destroys their environment, where do you think they're going to go? So in a sense, Meskwakis could go back 200 years. It would be kind of hard at first. Inconvenience. But it's just an inconvenience. No cell phone. You know. But
you would survive.
But we would survive. So that's how I think I'm going to end it, that we survive.
Thank you, Jonathan.
You're welcome.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Today we have been discussing the beautiful topic of wild foxes in the area, an exploration which also led to the Meskwaki people to gain understanding about their association with foxes. Today we spoke with Roger Hill in Roland, who is a nature photographer, Ron Andrews in Clear Lake, who is a retired research biologist, Hans Geppinger in Boone County, who is a farmer and an environmentalist, Jonathan Buffalo in the Meskwaki settlement, who is the historic preservation director, museum director, and tribal historian for the Meskwaki Tribal Council. You can find out more about the Meskwaki people at meskwaki.org. That's MESKWAKI.ORG. My name is Pat Schlarbaum. I've been your reporter and host this week. This show was edited with assistance from Ursula Rudenberg and Richard Morrison. Music you heard today has included Jigger from the album Celtic Moods and Irish Folk by UVS Music, Foxy Lady by Jimi Hendrix from the album Are You Experienced, What a Wonderful World by Christina Castaneda from the album Searching for the Cosmic Groove by Big Blue Sky, Voices of the Wind by Wayira from the album Voices of the Wind, and Fire by Wayira from the album Voices of the Wind. And the theme song for Local Talk is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their album The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. You can hear this show and all our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org, and see listings of our guests and resource contact information. Find Local Talk under the Shows tab. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. And here's hoping all citizens of the natural world are pleasantly surprised to view foxes, these incredibly beautiful, highly adaptable, and highly desirable watchable wildlife species. They can provide a touchstone of wildness to each of our lives. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.